This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Returning to the show this week is Peter Ames Carlin. Peter Ames Carlin is the author of several fine biographies, including Catch a Wave, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Beach Boys' Brian Wilson, biographies of Paul McCartney and Bruce Springsteen, and Peter Ames Carlin's latest book, Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. Peter Ames Carlin, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here again.
You know, in a way, you've been writing like a multi-volume history of rock music of the last 60 years.
In a sense, yeah. You know, I mean, I always get into these things. I mean, obviously, I love the music, and I always have done since I was a really little kid. I was a little precocious in my rock and roll tastes due to having some kind of hep cat parents. But the thing that always draws me to one artist over the other, I think, I really get caught up in the kind of sociocultural aspect of it. I mean, obviously the music is forefront to what I'm talking about, but in essentially all these guys, particularly the American artists, which are 3 out of 4 for me so far, there's always such an interesting connection to, you know, America as an ideal, or America, you know, American history and the politics of the day. You know, music just seems inherently political, no matter what is going on and no matter the perspective of the artist. You know, it always fits in there somewhere. And between the music and the personal stories, and particularly that stuff, I mean, I think, you know, there's just so much fascinating story to be told.
Yeah, so you're not only telling us the lives of these people, but the times in which they lived.
Exactly, you know, that backdrop and sort of what they evoke about the, you know, American ideals, and that, as Springsteen says, you know, the distance between our American ideals and the America that actually exists.
And America, and the theme of America is something that runs through Paul Simon's work. Is that what drew you to Paul Simon?
Well, to an extent, I mean, it's like every cylinder firing. You know, I'd known Paul's music since I was 5 years old, when, you know, I was sitting in the backyard of my parents' house in the summer of 1968 as a little kid, and Mrs. Robinson was such a huge hit. They played it on the AM radios that sort of blared from every direction that hot summer, with Mrs. Robinson just over and over and over again. And so that was imprinted on me pretty early.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey.
From that point forward, really, you know, from grade school all the way up through today, Paul Simon music has been a part of the backdrop of my life. And so there's that, and you know, that aspect of it, and following it so closely because I enjoyed it so much. But then also, you know, the more I got into it, the more fascinated I was by what his life is, sort of represents about not only just the American history over the last 50 or 60 years, but also just the entire kind of immigrant saga in America going back to the early part of the 20th century. Paul's family, like my family, were immigrant Jews from Eastern Europe, and that process of going from, you know, the original immigrants that come to the country who are still wrapped up in, you know, to a great extent in old world traditions and orthodoxy, sort of within a generation or two, end up, you know, the family moves, you know, so deeply into the American experience, you know, that sort of assimilation into mainstream American culture, that it's, you know, that's such a profound story, and the Simon family story, and Paul's story in particular, tell that story in miniature, you know. Except miniature is not the right word given the huge canvas that Paul's been drawing on this entire time. But that very much, and also his connection with so many of the mammoth events of the day, from the civil rights movement to the folk movement in the late 50s and early 60s, the Monterey Pop Festival, which he was a board member at the start of Saturday Night Live, and his role in Woody Allen's Annie Hall, and onward through the anti-apartheid movement, in one way, shape, or form or the other. And it's just this endless kind of social saga with this excellent soundtrack to it.
It's no small thing that Simon and Garfunkel called themselves Simon and Garfunkel, and that was really kind of a milestone in the history of the Jewish people, because up until then, Gershwin and Irving Berlin and so many famous musicians who were Jewish, they didn't necessarily deny their Judaism, but they hid their obvious Judaism by changing their names.
Absolutely, yes. No, it was a grand tradition, and Paul and Artie followed in it as far as they could, really. I mean, Paul's father was a professional musician, Louis Simon, but performed professionally exclusively under the name Lee Sims. When Paul and Artie got started in the mid-50s as a kind of a pop, sort of teen idol duo, they performed as Tom and Jerry, and they each took kind of non-ethnic last names. Artie called himself Tom Graff because of, you know, he was deeply into mathematics and did a lot, you know, liked to make graphs of things. Paul just called himself Jerry Landis. The last name, I think, belonged to a girlfriend he'd had as a high school kid. And for the next 8 years or so, Paul continued to work as Jerry Landis until his first step into the folk world. He sort of copyrighted a few tunes and performed them as Paul Kane, another WASPy surname, obviously. And in fact, even though Paul and Artie have told the story the opposite way, there are several sources, including the producer at Columbia Records who signed them, a fellow named Tom Wilson, who was also Bob Dylan's producer. He brought them into the company and got into, and as according to his telling of the story, and I've heard other people describe the same thing, they were the ones who wanted to continue, start their folk career under a different WASPy pseudonym. You know, they wanted to be called, first they started out as Kane and Gar, and then after Paul had some success in England as Paul Simon, he thought, okay, how about Simon and Gar, or Simon and Garfield, something like that.
But never considered Garfunkel.
Because, yeah, no, Garfunkel was way too Jewish, according to, you know, Paul. I think Artie was beginning to sort of soften and kind of decided that if Paul was going to be Simon, he might as well be Garfunkel as well. And it took a vice president at Columbia to say, guys, look, it's 1964, you're going to be Simon and Garfunkel. And so it was, but that was against their better instincts at the time, and they were true, you know, and they weren't incorrect. I mean, there was a lot of anti-Semitism, particularly among, like, Midwestern radio programmers and that sort of thing. So it was a very real concern, and they did indeed make a big statement, voluntarily or not, when they came out as Simon and Garfunkel. I mean, even Bob Dylan, as we all know, is named Bob Zimmerman. So, you know, and he created a whole new character to go along with his Dylan persona.
Well, Paul Simon's career kind of straddles two distinct eras of popular songwriting. I mean, he began as a brill-building songwriter, plugging pop songs to other artists in the era of King and Goffin and the like, an era where singers were not songwriters. You know, Sinatra never wrote a song, or Elvis never wrote a song. But after the Beatles and Dylan, everything changed.
I mean, he broke the mold to some extent because, I mean, in those early days, because that first hit that Paul and Artie had as Tom and Jerry was a song they had co-written, Hey Schoolgirl in the Second Row. And I think they wrote, or Paul wrote, the rest of their songs, which there weren't very many of, and all of them were flops. But he continued when he went to college, at Queens College in the late 50s into the early 60s, he continued sort of writing and performing under the name Jerry Landis. But Jerry Landis also was happy to write tunes for other artists, and and take all kinds of other jobs, you know, briefly as an A&R executive, even the vice president of A&R at a small independent record company called Amy Records in New York City, and also as a with a song publishing company called Edward Marks, where he was working when he managed to get Tom Wilson to listen to his new song, Sound of Silence, trying to plug it for another group that Wilson was putting together as a kind of answer, sort of an African-American answer to Peter, Paul, and Mary. And then once Wilson fell in love with the tune, Paul said, well, wait a minute, you know, I actually sing this with my buddy Artie. You know, let us audition it for you and see what you think of this. And that's what got them going. But he does. He straddles. The other thing that's interesting to note is that first Tom and Jerry record that came out in the fall of 1957 was released not only as a 45, but also as a 78. You know, that was like the last gasps of the 78 RPM format that was the primary format for recorded music on discs from, like, you know, through the jazz era, you know, and into the big band era and onward up till, you know, into rock and roll. And just for a few years here, they were coming out in both formats. And, of course, now, you know, Paul's latest record, Stranger to Stranger, was a hit in the midst of, you know, streaming music and MP3s and, you know, and Spotify and Apple Music and all that stuff.
I'm waiting for the 78 RPM version to come out.
Yeah. That's when they'll... That's when things will really have turned around in the music industry, when suddenly everyone's like, no, man, you know, vinyl's not good enough. It's, you got to get to 78. You know, that's the really high, you know, that's the really, really high high fidelity.
You know, was any relationship in the history of music ever as complex as Simon and Garfunkel? I mean, they went from being schoolboy chums to being like the Sunshine Boys, you know, two old feuding show business Jews.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the interesting thing is, I've sort of managed to trace, like, the original sin in the Simon and Garfunkel relationship goes back to actually before they signed the very first contract for Tom and Jerry when they were still seniors in high school. Because Paul... when the record company owner who signed them or wanted to sign them and put out their record was negotiating the deal for the boys with Paul's father and Paul himself, because Paul's dad was in the music industry and knew a thing or two about recording contracts, they hammered out a side deal to sort of leverage this early seeming success for Paul and Artie into a solo career for Paul, and so he secretly went out with his dad and recorded, you know, even as Hey Schoolgirl was jumping up the charts and he and Artie were getting their first ever taste of fame, you know, they were secretly writing and recording Paul's first solo single, which came out under a whole other pseudonym, True Taylor, but of course they, you know, Paul had to confess to Artie right before the record came out, and Artie was understandably furious. It's like, we have this, you know, we've worked for years for this success together, and the first thing you do is go behind my back and try to start a solo career, you know, leveraging our joint success, you know, and they went their separate ways kind of naturally after that, I think. But the you know, just to go to college, and of course they got back together and had a very productive and loving relationship through the 60s, but that envy, you know, that spark of dissonance between them, to mix metaphors, you know, persisted through the Simon and Garfunkel era, and was a major cause to their breakup after Bridge Over Troubled Water, and I think a lot of their inability to maintain their relationship since then has been flowed from that, you know, that first moment, that sort of first theme in the foundation of their friendship. You know, Paul talks in the mid-80s of when they were on tour after the Central Park concert in the early 80s and trying to record a reunion record, you know, an original new record that ultimately fell apart. He said that he was arguing with Artie about stuff in general, like why Artie didn't seem to like him anymore, and Artie went back to that moment in 1957 And Paul said, geez, you know, I was 15 years old. You know, 25 years have gone by. You got to let that go. I mean, I was just a kid then. And Artie's response was, you're still the same guy. So some things just don't fade.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Tonight we're talking with Peter Ames Carlin. His new book is called Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. Well, I was thinking about one of the things that you talked about in the book, which was when Paul Simon did his second concert in Central Park, and he didn't invite Artie to participate, and Art Garfunkel left New York to get away. And it seems like, you know, you could definitely see both sides of that story. Like, well, Paul Simon was doing something that was completely different than the Simon and Garfunkel sound, and he wanted to get, you know, it wasn't a part of what he was doing. But on the other hand, how would it have hurt, and who would have objected in the audience to him bringing Artie on for a couple of songs?
Well, I think it wasn't, I mean, the audience would have loved it, but for Paul, I think that moment, the moment that started with Graceland and continued to through Rhythm of the Saints, which was the record he was touring for when he played that second huge concert in Central Park, that was Paul's like hugest moment as a solo artist, and he was, you know, it was amazing. I mean, I don't know if you saw that tour. I certainly did, and there's a beautiful live recording of the show that you can still get, you know, of that Central Park show in 91, but it's a summation of the whole tour. And, you know, Paul plays maybe three or four Simon and Garfunkel songs, and they're like afterthoughts, really. I mean, the whole thing, people are there, you know. They said it was $750,000, $750,000 people, but those numbers are always, you know, kind of trumped up, and you know. But that's what they say. It's like they're there for him. They're not there to, you know, for Simon and Garfunkel. You know, he doesn't. Finally, he's reached that moment where, you know, he's triumphed without, you know, truly, truly triumphed without Artie at his side. And for Paul, I mean, I think there was no overstating what that symbolized for him. And, you know, I understand Artie's hurt feelings and everything, and just given the context of their long relationship, it makes perfect sense. But still, it's, you know, it's sort of, again, it sort of feeds into that kind of constant feuding. The other thing I discovered that was interesting is that even when they got back together in the early 60s as kind of a folk act, and they were... And when Sound of Silence finally broke through and became a big enough hit for the Columbia Records publicity people to put together an official bio of the group and really go hammer and tongs at the publicity stuff, you know, this bio of these young guys that they put together, which was 2.5 or 3 pages, already was talking about their feuds and how they'd broken up after their first successes, teen musicians. But then went through a period they described at the time of digging themselves, you know, it was sort of a dig-yourself competition, is what one of them says. But now we're sort of over that. You know, so this whole idea of the dissonance and darkness sort of underneath their beautiful harmonies and the kind of light that creates has always sort of been a source of, you know, tension and sometimes kind of beautiful tension. It's like the undercurrent to the wave that, you know, in some ways makes, you could argue, makes the harmonies, you know, feel a little sweeter in your ear to know that what that symbolizes in the ongoing feud between these guys.
It's part of their legend.
Yes, very much a part of their legend, and they have consciously played it up at times, even though, you know, it seems that it's also very real for them too.
Well, you've written about two other great musicians that were part of great groups, Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys and Paul McCartney of, what was that band that McCartney was in? Oh, yeah, the Beatles.
Wings. Yes, of course, the Beatles.
And, you know, neither of them, they both went on to make great, great solo music, especially Paul's made dozens and dozens of solo albums. And as great as many of them are, neither of those guys can touch the music they made with their bands. But Paul Simon's music is really, you know, I mean, it stands alone. It's equally as great as the music he made with Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in a different way, of course. And there's something about Simon and Garfunkel that's, I mean, you could argue, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you could argue it a lot of different ways. But Paul Simon definitely has, you know, has had a phenomenal solo career. I mean, when he first went to Clive Davis, who was then of Columbia Records, to tell him that he was going to go solo, you know, Clive was, of course, understandably, you know, dismayed, because Simon and Garfunkel were not only the biggest band at, you know, the biggest artists in at Columbia Records right then, but the biggest artists in the world. I mean, they just come off of selling, at the time, you know, an unbelievable 12 million copies of Bridge Over Troubled Water. And now you're telling me there's not going to be a follow-up to that? You know, that act, that hugest of all possible acts, is you know, who have actually, you know, eclipsed the Beatles in some ways. You know, you guys are breaking up. And Paul, you know, I think he understood what Clive's position was, but he also got a little hot under the collar, and he said to him at the time, it seemed absurd. He goes, yeah, well, maybe someday people are going to look back at the Simon and Garfunkel years as sort of this sort of preamble to the huge solo career I have. And, you know, and that's almost how it went, you know, almost how it played out. I mean, when you look back at it, I mean...
Well, especially during the Graceland era. I mean, that album was tremendous.
Yeah, but you also can't... But, I mean, it's just been hit after hit after hit for the guy. I mean, if you go back through, you know, his early solo records, like There Goes Rhyme and Simon and Still Crazy After All These Years, I mean, these are smash albums that had multiple hits on them. Like
Still Crazy After All These Years did win the Grammy for Album of the Year.
Yeah, it did. It did. It did. And then he did it again with Graceland, of course. You know, not that the Grammys are necessarily a real accurate measure of aesthetics or anything, but I guess they do in a lot of ways kind of measure your popular success.
I do remember that Paul Simon thanked Stevie Wonder in 1976 for not putting out an album that year.
Yes, yes, of course, of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Stevie was a big machine, was a huge hit machine in those days, too.
Well, which makes me think of the other aspect of Paul Simon that I have always loved and identified with, and you mentioned it briefly. You know, he's funny.
Yeah.
He was the host of the second episode of Saturday Night Live. He made a great television special not long after that, the Paul Simon special. He's a funny guy.
He always, and that was a thing. He became such close friends with Lorne Michaels, the, you know, sort of founding producer of Saturday Night Live, when Lorne moved to New York in the summer or spring of 75 to start putting the show together. You know, and Lorne had a very tight team of other writers and actors who were part of that early, you know, the invention of that show. But he also was hanging out with Paul all the time, and so Paul sort of naturally became part of, like, their working dinners. And, you know, I mean, Danny Aykroyd has talked about how one of his most famous early sketches, the Bass-O-Matic, you know, the ad for the Bass-O-Matic, where it's just a blender that you throw a fish in and grind it up, and then, you know, it's like, there you go, you know, an entire meal of bass. But that he thought it was just a weird idea, but when he sort of threw it out at a dinner table, that Paul's sort of getting so hysterical laughing at it made him realize that, oh, I think that might actually be a good one after all. And of course he turned it into, you know, this unforgettable sketch. But Paul's work on Saturday Night Live in those early years was often unforgettable too. That moment when and he was consciously satirizing himself, which was a huge thing back at the time, because people, to the extent, you know, people knew Paul Simon as this somewhat morose and very serious folk and pop songwriter, you know, who sang about being alienated and feeling sad and, you know, and all that stuff. This kind of, you know, young misanthrope, really, in a lot of ways. But so he came out at the second time he hosted the show, the Thanksgiving episode of the second season, and he started the show. The cold opening was him on stage singing Still Crazy After All These Years while dressed in a turkey suit. you know, head to foot, this huge bizarre. And then he sort of gets partway through the song and he stops the band and he's like saying, you know, I wanted to be a regular guy. I didn't want to have to be so serious all the time, but I just don't think this is working at all. And it was. It was, you know, and he also had a fairly significant role in Woody Allen's classic movie, Annie Hall, you know, playing Tony Lacey, the kind of sleazy music producer from L.A. Coke spoon around his neck, and those two women surround it. You know, he invites Annie and Woody Allen's character, Alvie Singer, to a party. He says, is this going to be mellow? Just Jack and Angelica? You know, Jack Nicholson and Angelica Houston, who were like two of the hippest people in the world then, you know. And he wrote his own lines and kind of created his own, you know. Woody Allen sent him a script, and Paul said, yeah, I'll do it, but let me tell you what, I think I know this character better than you do, so you just let me write my own lines. And Woody was like, okay, fine, go for it. And that's what we see in the movie.
And you know that Saturday Night Live, when he dressed like a turkey, also provided one of the greatest musical moments, not only in Saturday Night Live history, but in history, when George Harrison and Paul Simon did that fantastic duet.
Yeah, they played two or three songs together, I think. The Boxer and Here Comes the Sun and maybe one other. Homeward Bound. Yeah, no, it wasn't. It was Homeward Bound, not The Boxer.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, what a great... What a great moment. I'm so glad it exists.
Yeah, well, that first episode he did, in the first season, of course, you know, the musical guests were Simon and Garfunkel, which was the first time they had actually, you know, reunited except for a George McGovern fundraiser in New York in 1972. But this was the first time, like, for the nation they had reunited. And they actually had a reunion single, My Little Town, that was a big hit that year. It was on both of their solo records. Paul had written for Artie, and they decided to do together. And there's just so much joy and teasing and affection in those performances. It's just really sweet to go back and see that again.
Yeah, their relationship, like we said, very complex. So let's answer this question. Why did Paul Simon decide to break away? Was it because it was the era of the solo album and everyone was making solo records?
No, you know, I mean, it was just that they had worked together so closely for so long, and they had gotten in, and there was kind of a mutual dependence there that they both, obviously they needed each other to a degree, and they also resented each other for needing each other. You know, I mean, Artie was a great singer, but he didn't write songs, at least not whole songs. And Paul was a great songwriter, but he didn't have Artie's voice. You know, Paul has always been sensitive about his voice, which is, you know, a lesser instrument than Artie's, but he still sings beautifully. But Artie was tall and blonde and handsome and had this beautiful voice, and so I think he was kind of a security blanket for Paul during those early years. But I think Artie got tired of being dependent on Paul for his songwriting. And when he got a shot to start a movie career and had, you know, some early success there, it was like, what do I need Paul Simon for? So, you know, he eventually, in the same way, you know, or I think he felt like, you know, I want to get this break from Paul. I want to be my own artist. And, you know, and obviously there are songs, you know, one of the interesting things about that beautiful record, Bridge Over Troubled Water, is how much the songs explore their relationship. You know, not only sort of sonically, just in the fact that Paul, after writing the song that he knew was the best song he'd written so far in his life, you know, Bridge Over Troubled Water, he handed it right over to Artie to sing because he knew his voice couldn't do the justice to the song that Artie's could. Which I thought was an incredible gesture, and he speaks directly to Artie and encouraging him to start his movie career in The Only Living Boy in New York. You know, Tom, you know, he addresses him as Tom from Tom and Jerry, you know, their old pseudonym. You know, catch your flight right on time. You know, I know that you've been eager to shine, you know, to fly now. And it's a beautiful, loving tune, but then there's also... the song So Long, Frank Lloyd Wright. Artie had suggested to Paul that he write a song about Frank Lloyd Wright because Artie was a huge architecture buff and had studied to be an architect for a while in college. And so the song Paul ended up writing was essentially, you know, was called So Long, Frank Lloyd Wright, and it's basically a sort of a loving separation song to Artie. Like, our relationship has, you know, it's been beautiful, but I think we both know it has to end now, you know? So the Frank Lloyd Wright in the song is actually Artie, you know, the whole thing about harmonizing all night long and how you know, how they laugh together and all this, and that beautiful moment when he says, "When I run dry, I stop a while and think of you." You know, because Artie really was his muse, I think, for a lot of those Simon and Garfunkel songs. And so that that album is so shot through with ambivalence about their breakup, you know, their frustration with each other, the fact that Artie physically wasn't present for so many of the sessions because he was down in Mexico, and Paul missed him and was angry that he wasn't there, I think that in a lot of ways is this huge emotional undercurrent, which is, you know, not really ever acknowledged explicitly. But listening back to the album now, I mean, that's what I find the most, you know, sort of astonishing and moving about that record.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking tonight with Peter Ames Carlin. He is the author of a new biography of Paul Simon called Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. As a solo artist, and I guess within Simon and Garfunkel also, when you think of El Condor Pasa and some of the other things, Paul Simon was always, you know, in search of the eclectic, going to where the musicians are.
Yes, exactly. I mean, he always had a fascinating a fascination for the music and cultures of other people. And one of the interesting things I learned when I was writing and studying about the Graceland era, I spoke to the South African musician Johnny Clegg, who was the co-leader and founder of a band called Jaluka, which was a mixed-race band, a pop band in South Africa, because Johnny grew up in a town that was rich with members of the Zulu tribe. And he became so enamored of their culture and such an eager participant in learning how to play the music and learning how to do the folk dances, they called him an honorary Zulu. But the fascinating thing is that Johnny Clegg is also a Jewish immigrant. His family came from Poland, I think, in the years before World War II, and ended up in South Africa. And Johnny's also a student of anthropology, and I think actually teaches anthropology at the college level out there in South Africa too. And he said assimilation, you know, that secular Jews have an incredible interest in other people's cultures because they've sort of cut themselves off from their own culture and their own past, and so they're famished for other cultures and learning about them and finding a way to sort of get inside of them and participate and take on, you know, their traditions in some way, or at least to an extent, and to me that explained a lot about Paul's career over the years, and his constant moving from sort of style to style and place to place and culture to culture. It always struck me as kind of the assimilation process just sort of restated over and over again in musical terms. And when I spoke to Johnny Clegg about it, you know, and Johnny was very involved with Paul, or to some extent was advising Paul when Paul came to South Africa and ran afoul of the ANC and the UN, the African National Congress and the United Nations a cultural boycott. They were trying to keep countries and other countries from dealing with the apartheid government in South Africa. They wanted to, you know, get them as isolated as possible, as a way to topple the government and bring back the rule of, you know, the actual natives of the country, which eventually did happen, of course. But Johnny Clegg was part of trying to help him understand all that. So he, you know, his his understandings of Paul's motivations and his insight into the culture of secular Jews, I think, was fascinating.
Also, I think it's interesting that Paul Simon is always willing to step outside his comfort zone. And two of those projects, his movie, One Trick Pony, and his Broadway show, Cape Man, both of which were like the first thing I think he ever did that was very poorly received was One Trick Pony. But now, you know, I think anybody looking back on both of those projects sees how brilliant they were.
Well, the movie was, you know, I mean, it's a good B movie, essentially. And it was received at first by, you know, very good reviews. I mean, Ebert and Siskel both gave it thumbs up. You know, that was back in the early days when they were still on PBS, but their influence was building at the time. They both really enjoyed that movie and gave it great reviews. I think it got a pretty respectful review in the New York Times at first. But then there was this wave of sourness about it, and that kind of ended up writing the story. But ultimately, I think even the good reviews at first just didn't bring, as I say, didn't put asses in the seats, you know, which is kind of what you're, you know, what it's sort of all about, but you know, not just in popular music, but also in cinema.
Right. I mean, it's kind of like we're talking about with the Grammy Awards. I mean, if you sell a lot of records, then that makes it a good record. Or if you sell a lot of tickets, that makes it a good movie.
Yeah.
Not necessarily.
It's still a really interesting movie. I mean, it's, you know, somewhat autobiographical in a lot of ways, but, you know, the character that he plays in that movie, Jonah Levin, whose initials, you'll note, are the same as the first pseudonym Paul used, Jerry Landis, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and Lou Reed's in it, and Rip Torn, and, you know, and parts of it are, you know, he's getting some revenge at the Columbia, the president of Columbia Records, who kind of ran him off the label, Walter Yetnikoff. They sort of loathed each other from the start. You know, so that was, you know, in the soundtrack, I mean, it didn't quite, the album didn't quite make the top 10, which was a huge come down for Paul at the time. And, you know, the single, you know, it only had one significant hit single, and, the, you know, the next one was only, only made the top 20 or something. So what a huge disaster that was. You know, I mean, a lot of it is a question of perspective.
It's interesting that in his current tour, I saw him at the Greek Theater in San Francisco in June, and of all of the songs in all of the solo albums, you know, he can't do everything in this short, you know, 2 hour set, but he definitely included a song from One Trick Pony in that set.
Was it Late in the Evening?
Right.
Yeah, that's the one that's been a big hit. That was a top five hit for him. And it's always been a killer on stage, so he's never shied away. That's always been one of his on-stage faves because, you know, people jump up and are singing along. I mean, it's a great party tune. But when he got to Broadway, though, I mean, he was coming off of his... He'd sort of been flirting with the idea of doing a Broadway musical for years and years. And at one point in the late 60s, even signed on to write the music for a musical, an original musical that Dustin Hoffman ended up, was going to star in. Singing and dancing, you know, like you don't think of when it comes to Dustin Hoffman,
a great song and dance man.
Yeah, you know, but apparently, you know, he's got the skills and the training, and it just didn't quite come together for him, I don't think, in the end. Or no, actually, I think he was in it all the way through, but the music, Paul signed on to do the music and then then left, and John Sebastian from the Love and Spoonful took it over. The play just... For a bit of trivia, a bit of Peter Carlin trivia, which I know a lot of people love.
Oh, yes.
It was written by a guy who worked with Dustin Hoffman a lot named Murray Shizgle. And his son, Zach Shizgle, edited my first two books. He's still a good friend of mine, still a lovely guy.
But, Murray Shizgle, who wrote Love and...
Yeah, but Murray also co-wrote Tootsie with Dustin Hoffman. So
really?
He was
the Dustin Hoffman
part of that
connection.
Thing. Yeah, but that's... But enough with the trivia. Paul's problem when he finally did get to Broadway in the 90s, and he came up with this idea to do a musical about, you know, the Cape Man, this kid, this young street gang member in the late 50s who was involved in some, you know, a playground fight that turned murderous, and he was convicted of stabbing a couple guys to death, and ended up going to jail first, you know, headed in first to death row, and then subsequently, I think Governor Rockefeller commuted his sentence, and he was just going to be in jail for the rest of his life, but eventually he did get paroled and had in many ways kind of redeemed himself. But the problem, so he felt very close to that story and wrote a lot of great music, a lot of great songs, but he also wanted to write the play, at least co-wrote it with the poet Derek Walcott, and had a very difficult time allowing a director and other professionals. I mean, Broadway shows are enormous machines with all kinds of moving parts, and you need a whole bunch of people working at the top of their game to make it work. But Paul, who was so accustomed to being in control of every aspect of his records and really only knew that, you know, that way of doing business creatively, just couldn't let the authority go. And his presence, you know, just kind of made the show, I think, a very difficult and painful process for everyone, and he alienated a lot of Broadway. You know, he said a lot of things to the media that were very unfriendly to Broadway just as a place, and very sort of scoffing about their traditions and the way they go about business, and how he was going to kind of remake the Broadway musical for the modern world. And so in a weird way, he finally at this point in his career, he sort of refused to do the assimilation. You know, it's like he walked up to this place, locked the door, and then ran back, you know, stepped back, and then tried to ram the door he had locked with his head to see if he could open it that way, and it just didn't work out, you know. But the music is beautiful. If you buy, you can actually get the original soundtrack to the show, I think on iTunes. It just became an iTunes release, but you can buy Paul's version. The songs from The Caveman came out, I think, in the fall of 97. And it has a lot of very, very beautiful music. I was just listening to it today, in fact.
What's a song from there that you think people should have heard that neglected?
There's a, you know, he wrote in so many different styles, but there's this beautiful doo-wop song that opens it up called Adios Hermanos, which it's a cappella, and it's just an old-fashioned doo-wop song that kind of sets the stage for the character. And I think that's fantastic. There's some other... there's a tune called Vampires, which is about the street gang that he was in that I love. Just great old rock and roll tunes. There's one called Bernadette. You know, he writes in a whole variety of styles, you know, from that early rock and roll and doo-wop all the way up through, you know, Latin, different kinds of Latin rhythms and Puerto Rican rhythms and styles. And it's just this amazing kind of multifaceted cultural work. But the show itself, he just couldn't, you know, he just didn't know how to function and kind of refused to learn how. But the show has been revived, you know, so it was a huge flop. I mean, it lost millions and millions of dollars in 98 when it finally opened. But when it was finally revived, at first at Ish, the show is at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in Brooklyn. They had a whole month of shows. They had three different shows they put together to sort of celebrate Paul's entire career. So there was kind of a Simon and Garfunkel, you know, singer-songwriter, sort of Simon and Garfunkel through the early 70s stuff, and then there was the Graceland and Rhythm of the Saints stuff, and then they had a night for the songs from The Caveman. And that was so well-reviewed, they actually revived it as a kind of libretto for... actually, that's not the word I'm looking for. Sort of a song cycle that they performed at Central Park, and there was talk of that going back to, you know, it was more music-based. Sort of they lost a bunch of the plot and the second act that didn't work at all, but that didn't quite find its way back to Broadway yet. But you just can't count it out.
Well, there have been books about Paul McCartney, lots and lots of them, and there have been a few books about Brian Wilson, and there's a few Bruce Springsteen books. But this is the biography of Paul Simon.
Thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. I mean, obviously, it's sort of what I set out to do, so it's enormously gratifying to hear you say that.
And thank you so much for Peter Ames Carlin. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
It's my pleasure, Gary. Thanks for having me back.
¶¶ that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Peter Ames Carlin. His latest book, Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.